Good day. Today is Friday, 5th December 2025. Let me take this opportunity before I start this programme to remind you, if once you've watched the programme or whichever part of the programme you want to watch, you've liked the programme, you decide you've liked the programme and you want to indicate the fact, please do in that case tick the like button to indicate that fact. Anyway, let me proceed now with the programme today, and it's going to be almost exclusively again about the situation with Ukraine. And before I get into the substance of the discussions about Ukraine, can I just deal with two stories that have been circulating quite widely over the last few months? The one about the gasoline shortages resulting from the refinery attacks, the drone attacks, the Ukrainian drone attacks on the Russian refineries. And the other, the story about the supposed halt of Russian oil exports to India. Because we have had information in the media over the last 24 hours, which basically contradicts, well, doesn't just contradict, it demolishes both of these stories. Now, I find this interesting because, of course, on this channel, in these programs, I have pushed back hard against both of these stories. And we've done the same on the Duran. But of course, both of these stories have been very, very heavily promoted in the mainstream media and the major legacy media in the West. There have been long articles and commentaries based upon them. There have been all sorts of interesting theories and speculations about what would happen in Russia based upon these stories. And now, of course, it turns out that neither of these stories were true. Let's start first with the attack on the refineries. Now, a newspaper called Moscow Times, which is, by the way, not a Russian newspaper. It is actually published in Amsterdam, I believe, in the Netherlands, but which does, of course, heavily report on Russia and which did used to be based in Russia and was very widely circulated amongst the English-speaking expat community there, and which was, by the way, in my opinion, and probably still is, the source of many of the stories that you see in the media speculating about Kremlin intrigues and other matters. Anyway, that newspaper, which can by no stretch of the imagination be considered pro-Putin or sympathetic to the current Russian government or supportive of the Russian war in Ukraine or any of these things. On the contrary, it is massively hostile to all of these things. Anyway, Moscow Times has now investigated the whole issue of the so-called gasoline shortage in Russia. And the title of the article, which appears on the 3rd of December 2025, 2 days ago, says, the title is, did Russia really have a gasoline crisis? Question mark. New data suggests otherwise. And the article, by the way, is by a journalist called Dmitry Nekrasov. Now, the article is based upon a survey that was carried out across Russia. There was a sample originally of 1,600 respondents across the country, including Crimea and Sevastopol. Those members of the sample who did not drive personal vehicles were then excluded from it, and that left a sample of 1,158 individuals. And they were asked whether they'd experienced gasoline shortages. And, well, The reports, they say the following. Nationwide, 24% of respondents encountered the absence of their preferred gasoline station, gasoline grade at a station during the past 3 months. 11% experienced this once or twice, 7% three to five times, and 6% more than five times. Only 10% of those who ran into a shortage, 2.4% of the entire sample, were unable to find gasoline anywhere that same day. Most people simply filled up at the next station. 18% had encountered unusually long lines, though nearly half of those waited less than 20 minutes. And as the Moscow Times points out, that's hardly the stuff of crisis and more likely a reflection of how media narratives shape perception. Only 6% had experienced purchase limits and fewer than 1% faced them more than five times. In most regions, there was no physical fuel shortage at all. The problems were concentrated amongst small, struggling gas station chains, some of which soon closed. We're told that the picture was different in Crimea. 70% of respondents encountered empty pumps. 26% faced shortages more than five times. Nearly half of those affected could not find gasoline anywhere that same day. 61% had experienced purchase limits and 40% faced unusual lines. And the point is, as Moscow Times says, nonetheless, the data confirms that unlike the rest of the country, Crimea did experience a genuine gasoline crisis. Still, the relatively small share of people repeating problems suggest that even there, in Crimea, the disruptions were not long-lasting. And, well, there it is. That's the basic samples. I mean, there's a lot more details about the samples altogether, and there's attempts to break them down demographically and all that. I'm not sure why that's important. And the article concludes by saying this. At the height of claims that fuel shortages were caused by Ukrainian strikes on Russian oil refineries, it was already clear that the situation would resolve itself within 1 or 2 months for seasonal reasons alone. And that is exactly what happened. Reports of shortages have faded from the news cycle, and gasoline prices have been falling for 3 weeks. The conversation will, however, almost certainly be back next year as August approaches again. Despite all logic, many outlets will again blame refinery strikes for what are largely predictable seasonal dynamics. In other words, in August, in the summer, many people in Russia go on holiday. They drive to the various holiday resorts on the Black Sea and in Crimea in their cars. That can place heavy demand on local gas stations. Sometimes that causes shortages, and there were specific shortages in August of this year. Little different from what happens at the same time of year in any other year. And the article concludes, even if the war ends, localized fuel shortages during the vacation season will likely continue. Perhaps the media will again look to last year's attacks for an explanation. At least now, when the next crisis, and the word crisis is in inverted commas, arrives, we'll have a point of comparison. So there it is. I said at the time that the refinery strikes, these drone strikes on the refineries, were making minimal difference probably no substantive difference at all. I said that it's absolutely typical for there to be gasoline shortages in Russian resort regions in late summer because of excess demand during the summer vacation period. We've now had a proper study of the matter by the Moscow Times, which, as I said, is a newspaper profoundly unfriendly to the Putin government and published in the West. And, of course, it is exactly as we said on the Duran, I said on this channel, as all sorts of other people's, Stanislav Krapivnik, many other people were saying all along. The whole story of the refinery strikes, the gasoline shortage, was a fantasy. It was fiction. Fiction based on Ukrainian propaganda, smoke appearing from refineries, all of that kind of thing after strikes. The smoke, of course, tells us very little about the actual damage to the refineries and the real extent of any gasoline shortages. But just take your mind back to the reporting of just a few months ago. Remember the claims that more than a third of Russia's refining capacity had supposedly been disabled. Remember the long articles that were written about how the combination of the Ukrainian strikes on the refineries and the European Union's and Donald Trump's attempts to choke off Russian exports would precipitate a crisis, a financial crisis inside Russia. Remember Donald Trump himself publishing on Truth Social comments about how the Russian people might want to ask who was responsible for their problems as they queued for gasoline? Well, none of it was true. None of it had any real basis in reality. Obviously, there were drone strikes on the refineries, but as I always said, they did minimal damage. And the gigantic Russian energy complex absorbed them with hardly any problems at all. In fact, you could say that all that those drone strikes really did, actually did, was scratch the paint a little. Now, what about the oil exports? Well, the oil exports are an even more interesting story in some ways, and they tend to focus now mostly on India, and of course everything cranked up to fever pitch after the United States announced sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft. And for weeks after, and until very, very recently, just a few days ago, in fact, article after article was appearing all across the media saying that India had stopped buying Russian oil. President Trump of the United States said that he'd had a conversation with Prime Minister Modi of India. And over the course of that conversation, Prime Minister Modi had assured him that India would end all imports of oil from Russia by the end of this year. Anyway, and many people took that seriously. And again, there was all sorts of excited commentary across the media about how the combination of the EU sanctions against Russia's shadow fleet and the American sanctions against Lukoil and Rosneft, and the fact that the Indians were stopping purchases of Russian oil, how that was all going to deal a massive hole in the Russian budget and precipitate a crisis and bring about, ultimately, a financial crisis and perhaps a collapse in Russia, and would force Vladimir Putin, once his money had run out, to end the war on Western terms. Well, how many articles have appeared about this? Now, again, I've pushed back on this story. I pointed out that I have never seen a single article which has a genuine Indian provenance, as opposed to articles which have appeared in the Indian media, but which are traceable back to Western publications who syndicalize their articles in the Indian media. I'd not read a single article, actual Indian media article, that said that India was ending imports of Russian oil. Reliance, the big Indian refiner that was said to be ending imports of Russian oil, did release several statements which said that they would comply with sanctions. But if you read them carefully, they never said that they would stop buying Russian oil. And if Prime Minister Modi's office and the Indian Foreign Ministry specifically denied that there'd been any conversation between Modi and Trump, and that Modi had never assured Trump in a conversation, which of course never took place, that India would stop buying Russian oil by the end of this year. Well, yesterday I read in the Financial Times this article, an article which contained this comment. Donald Trump has accused Prime Minister Modi of helping fund Putin's war machine and complained that India buys most of its oil and military products from Russia, very little from the United States. In August, he imposed a 25% punitive tariff on Indian goods, bringing Washington's total levies to 50%. India has curtailed some oil purchases since then. Reliance, the owner of India's largest private oil refiner, said last month that it would stop using Russian crude following US sanctions on Russian oil producer Rosneft. This is not actually what Reliance said. My recollection is that what Reliance in fact said is that it would comply with the sanctions. That meant that it might not buy oil from Rosneft and Lukoil, but it would presumably leave itself the option of buying Russian oil. And in fact, other statements made by Reliance seemed to suggest that that was indeed the plan. And then the Financial Times goes on to say, but a complete halt to Russian imports is unlikely because discounted Russian barrels remain attractive, said Sumit Ritolia, a lead India analyst with KPLER. The Nayara Vadina refinery, which is backed by Rosneft and located in Modi's home state of Gujarat, is still buying Russian crude. The facility, India's second largest, is subject to UK and EU sanctions, but has not been targeted directly by the United States. So, India continues to import Russian oil. Much of it now goes through the Nayara Vadina refinery, the second biggest in India, but some of it also, I am sure, is refined by Reliance. And in fact, we've now had comments about this. These comments originate from Goldman Sachs. It turns out, according to Goldman Sachs, that Goldman Sachs says that oil exports from Lukoil and Rosneft are down 1.1 million barrels per day, but simultaneously, exports from other Russian non-sanctioned companies are up 1 million barrels per day. Russian oil trading networks are reorganizing quickly, says Goldman Sachs. And then Bloomberg has an interesting piece. It says that Moscow is struggling to supply crude oil under US sanctions. Seaborne shipments have increased by one-fifth over 3 months. That doesn't sound like they're struggling. But anyway, that's how Bloomberg describes it. According to the agency, Russia has steadily maintained deliveries at over 3 million barrels per day, but there are problems with transportation and uploading. The average travel time of crude from Kuzmino to Chinese ports has increased to 12 days for vessels loaded in November. Previously, it was no more than 8 days. But that might have all kinds of explanations, which might be completely unrelated to Western sanctions. Just saying. Again, if you have any knowledge of the shipping industry, you will know that it is not always the case that ships travel the same amount of time from one port to another. It can depend on all kinds of things: maritime traffic, climate conditions, sea conditions, all sorts of things. So that is actually, in my opinion, a red herring. But anyway, the article continues. Based on vessel tracking data, Russia shipped 3.46 million barrels per day over the 4 weeks ending November 30th, which is about 210,000 barrels more than the week before. This is the first increase since the US announced sanctions in mid-October against oil giants Rosneft and Lukoil. The average daily volume of shipments for the past week rose to 3.94 million barrels per day, which is roughly 690,000 barrels per day more than the previous week. So the sanctions against Lukoil and Rosneft came into effect on the 21st of November. And since then, exports by Russia of crude oil have increased. They've not fallen, they've increased. On average, for the month, the gross value of Russian exports remained unchanged at $1.13 billion per week, with higher export volumes offsetting the ninth consecutive decline in average prices. So there's been hardly any effect on Russian exports whatsoever. Russia continues to export oil to India. Russian oil exports are at about the same level as they had been before the American and EU sanctions were imposed. The EU sanctions, the 19th sanctions package, and the Lukoil and Rosneft sanctions have made no difference. Now, well, saying all of this, I do appreciate that it might provoke some kind of reaction in the United States once all of this data gets through. And it is not impossible that there will be demands over the next few days and weeks to tighten further the sanctions which have already been imposed. So the EU is now working on its 20th sanctions package. There have only been 19 others, just saying. And we all know what a devastating effect those have had. But nonetheless, the EU is now working on its 20th sanctions package. And there is always a chance that the United States might decide that the oil sanctions against Lukoil and Rosneft need strengthening. However, it's unlikely that that is going to have any significant effect. China continues to import Russian oil and has made it absolutely clear that it will not stop doing so and that it will look askance at any attempts by the United States to interfere in the trade between China and Russia on oil and energy or on any other matter. And as we have seen, as has been demonstrated over the course of this year, if the United States starts to apply economic and sanctions and tariff pressure against China, China is in a full position to retaliate. It's still got a lockhold over rare earths. It has all the high cards and the United States is most unlikely to do it. India, the other biggest importer of Russian oil, continues to import Russian oil. It is a huge economy. It is a country that the United States has been seeking to win over to its side in its conflict now with China. If the United States were to tighten sanctions on India or start enforcing secondary sanctions on India, sanctions that it is not applying against China, then I cannot imagine that this is not going to provoke an even more negative reaction in India than the one we are seeing. And even as I make this program, President Putin is in India. He was indeed received by Prime Minister Modi at the airport. They went to Modi's residence together in Modi's limousine, so I understand. The meeting has been hailed right across the Indian media in glowing terms. Apparently, a major package of economic and military cooperation deals is going to be unrolled today. I will discuss that all in much more detail. And for the record, in that long interview to the Indian media, which Putin gave and which I discussed yesterday, Putin said that Russian oil exports to India continue seamlessly, that there's been no reduction in oil exports, and that India and Russia are working on a massive upgrade in their economic cooperation. Now, it seems to me that if the United States does, in light of all of this, decide to enforce the sanctions or impose secondary sanctions on India, based on what has happened already, and I noticed that Putin spoke of Modi as a man, very soft-spoken, very polite in his dealings with Western leaders and indeed all leaders, but a man who nonetheless has basically a steel spine. I don't think I'm overstating what Putin said. Anyway, I am sure that all that that is going to do is it's going to distance India further from the United States and is going to deepen further the relationship between India and Russia. Now, here I think I'm going to make a few general points, and this is they are this. When Prime Minister Modi was first elected Prime Minister of India, about 10 years ago now, I remember that he came to the United States. He was received there rapturously. He gave an address to Congress. All of the signs suggested that India and the United States were going to forge a much closer relationship under a new, more nationalist government than the previous Congress government that had ruled India. And a government which, moreover, was expected to be more hostile to China and less enthusiastic about the BRICS than the previous Congress government in India had been. Now, I was sceptical that this would be the case, and I remember writing an article at the time, and I believe I even gave interviews at the time saying that I thought that India's general policy would not change as much as some people in the United States and elsewhere were expecting. But certainly it was the case that in India, at least, I think there was wide expectations at that time that the relationship with the United States would result in an enormous increase in US investment in India, that India, by opening up its doors to the United States, by aligning at least to some extent with the United States would attract the same levels of investment from the United States that China had attracted in the 1980s and 1990s, and which is widely believed, wrongly in my opinion, by the way, but widely believed to have kick-started China's industrial and economic rise. Anyway, it never quite turned out like that. A certain amount of investment by the United States, by US companies, by Apple and others in India did take place, though it's perhaps worth saying that there have always been significant industrial investments by US companies in India. But I think that it's probably fair to say that expectations in India of a huge surge in American investment over and above that which had already existed was somewhat disappointed. So I think the current Indian government, Prime Minister Modi's government, remains very focused on India's economic development, on its long-term industrialization, and its technological upgrading. Now, if the United States has not perhaps quite fulfilled the original expectations placed in it, and if there might be concerns about over-reliance on China for help with India's infrastructure, high technology, and industrial and manufacturing projects. And of course, India and China do have a complex and at times contentious relationship. Well, then it makes a great deal of sense for India to look back to its old trusted friend and partner, the country which throughout the time since India's independence in the 1940s has never let India down in any geopolitical conflict. The country which came to India's rescue, or rather, because that would be a wild overstatement, but which made clear its support for India during the Indo-Pakistani War of 1971. The country which in the 1960s had played a significant role in building up India's industrial and high technology base, and by the way, its military industrial base, and that of course is Russia. And well, 10, 15, 20 years ago, Russia would not have appeared an obvious partner for India. The Soviet Union was an industrial and technological colossus in the 1960s, or so it appeared, and so it was. But Russia, well, after the Soviet collapse, for a long time appeared as if it could not fulfill that role. But today, especially following the conflict in Ukraine, perceptions around the world are starting to change. People are beginning to take Russian manufacturing and industrial prowess and Russia's ability to develop infrastructure projects more seriously again, and people are also starting to take seriously Russia's successes in fields of technology and science. And so, well, obviously Russia is not going to completely fill the space here. India will want to continue to trade with China and with the United States, but there is a big role for Russia. And this is what this trip by Putin is all about. And the Russians are offering the Indians things that the Indians can never get from the United States. So India wants to have fifth generation fighter jets that it builds itself. The United States will not localize production of its F-35 fifth generation fighters in India. It will not supply the technology for India to undertake that production, or to produce fifth generation fighter jets on its own. Russia is prepared to do that. It was prepared to do that in the 1960s, and it is prepared to do that again. And it's prepared to provide India with more S-400 air defense missile systems, and it's prepared to provide India with the exceptionally advanced S-500 air defense missile system, which is only just now entering service in Russia itself, and which perhaps is best seen as an anti-ballistic missile system intended to counter intercontinental ballistic missiles. And apparently Russia is prepared to supply it, and Russia is prepared to cooperate with India in aircraft production. I mean civilian aircraft production. And Russia is prepared also to exchange with India information about building aircraft engines, both military aircraft engines and civilian aircraft engines. And it is not a one-way street, because Russia, as Putin also said in his recent interview, is the interview which I discussed yesterday, is now also working on a program to develop ties, economic ties with India, which will lead to a major expansion of Indian exports to Russia. And it's not difficult, again, to imagine what these might be. Areas like textiles, areas like soft, light consumer goods, which India can make very well. But also, as time passes, I am sure that India, which already has a significant industrial and technology base, will be able to provide help there for Russia too. And the Russians and the Indians are apparently also working on visa-free travel arrangements. And Russia's biggest bank, Sberbank, is apparently preparing to open branches in India, which means that the Mir card is going to be accepted across India, by the way. And there's talk that Russia, which needs 12 million workers by 2035, over and above those that it has, well, that it might be looking to import Indian labour, guest workers from India into Russia as well. And of course, Russian universities probably willing also to take on more Indian students. So both sides have much that they can offer to each other. And one can understand the economic and industrial and technological and military logic of their relationship. Now, if the United States were to come along now and start imposing more sanctions on India, trying to prevent this burgeoning relationship, then I can say very simply what would happen. The relationship would simply accelerate, and India would opt for even deeper integration into the BRICS. It would be extremely unwise for the United States to do that. I think this is understood in the United States. I think that as weeks passed and as the months pass, probably by some point mid-year next year, it will come to be seen that the sanctions against Lukoil and Rosneft were essentially a bluff. The United States had no real intention of enforcing them, because though it is obviously not going to be happy by this relationship between India and Russia, it would nonetheless, I think, prefer to see an India assertive and independent than an India which might integrate even more deeply into the BRICS and, as a result, move closer to the country that the United States has come to see as its greatest challenger and adversary, which is China. So anyway, there it is. Let's go back to all of that media commentary about the gasoline crisis and the oil crisis and the crisis in Russia's budget and all of those things. I will await with interest the articles which will now appear in the Financial Times, in the Daily Telegraph, in all sorts of other publications, in Bloomberg and Reuters, and in the United States, basically conceding that all of that commentary about choking off Russia's oil exports and the gasoline crisis in Russia and the success of the Ukrainian attacks on the refineries. I wait with interest to see all of these articles now appear, which will admit that all of that commentary was basically wrong. Well, of course, I will wait in vain, because one firm prediction I make is that those articles will never appear. We will just move on, as we always do, to the next topic of the discussion, which I predict will be more and further sanctions against Russia, with the constant, endless, unceasing assurances that the next sanctions will provide the silver bullet that will do the trick. We will never, ever see anyone go back, even as this enormous meeting between Putin and Modi in India, even as this tremendous trip is presented to us before our eyes, we will never see anyone admit, anyone acknowledge that any of the previous commentary and reporting was in any way wrong. Now, I've discussed this at some length because, of course, the same is even more true about the military situation. The military situation in Ukraine continues to deteriorate and get worse and worse for Ukraine. If we talk about the overall state of the war, there is a narrative that is now beginning to take increasing hold, and I just touched on it in my program yesterday, that Ukraine won some great victory in 2022 because the Russians, when they marched into Ukraine that year, were intent on taking over the whole country. The events of the first few weeks and months prove that that claim is wrong. Putin, of course, said it was wrong. On the very day that the special military operation was launched, he had a meeting in Moscow with Islam Aliyev, the president of Azerbaijan, in which he specifically denied that it was Russia's intention to occupy or annex the whole of Ukraine. The objectives set out by Putin at the start of the special military operation, and which the Russians have always insisted that they will fulfill in full, well, those make no mention of occupation or annexation of Ukraine. The day after the special military operation was launched, after President Zelensky announced that he was going to send a negotiating team to negotiate with the Russians and was prepared to drop Ukraine's objective of seeking NATO membership, on the very second day of the special military operation, Putin announced a ceasefire in order to enable the Ukrainian delegation to arrive in Belarus for the talks. It didn't, in fact, arrive in Belarus for the talks, and the special military operation then resumed over the course of the following day. On the very first day, however, of the special military operation, as Putin pointed out in his interview to the Indian media, and as I discussed yesterday, a Kremlin official acting on Putin's instructions, Dmitry Kozak, telephoned Kiev, spoke to Zelensky's officials, pointed out to the Ukrainians that all they needed to do was withdraw their forces from Donbass, and there would be no need for a war or for fighting at all. And over the course of the weeks that followed, over the course of March of 2022, negotiations between the Russians and the Ukrainians did take place. They were led on the Russian side by Vladimir Medinsky, Putin's aide, who is still Russia's chief negotiator. And they were led on the Ukrainian side by David Arakhamiya, who is the leader of Zelensky's faction in the Ukrainian parliament. And those meetings seemed to come to a consensus. And in early April, a document, the Minsk Agreement, was initialed by the two sides in draft. Now, I wish people would drop this story about Russia in the first few weeks of 2022, aiming for the complete conquest of Ukraine. Some of these claims are made in complete good faith. I can see also that in some cases, people are saying this in order to sugar the pill, so that if Ukraine is now persuaded to make the substantive, fundamental concessions that the Russians are demanding, Istanbul Plus, it can still be packaged in the West and in Ukraine itself as some kind of great victory for Ukraine, a victory whereby Ukraine has preserved its sovereignty and its independence and its statehood. But to reiterate again, the reality, the historical record of the first few weeks tells a completely different story of the Russians frustrated and alarmed by the deterioration of the situation in Eastern Europe and by what they saw as the inexorable slide of Ukraine towards NATO and of Ukrainian preparations to strike and try to reabsorb Donbass, of the Russians taking perhaps the desperate step of launching a special military operation, principally in order to bring the Ukrainians to their senses and to try to get them to come to an agreement which the Russians hoped would resolve the crisis once and for all. And the Russian gamble, and it needs to be said again, almost worked. An agreement was hammered out in draft, but of course, with the urging of the West and perhaps in conformity with Zelensky's own inclinations, the Ukrainians disastrously pulled back from it. And from that moment on, we have been continuing the war, and the war has gone worse and worse for Ukraine ever since. Now, it has to be said that in the last weeks of 2022, Ukraine did mount two offensives, one in Kharkiv region, one in Zaporozhye region, which did regain a great deal of territory and recapture the towns of Izium and Liman and Kupiansk in Kharkiv region and in Donbass and also the city of Kherson in Kherson region. And these, at the time, seemed like successes, except we now know from articles that were published in the New York Times that the objectives of both of these offensives were never achieved. In the first case, in the case of the Kharkiv offensive, the objective was to cut off Russian supply lines to Donbass, which was not achieved. And in the case of the Kherson offensive, it was to destroy the Russian forces located on the west bank of the Dnieper River in Kherson region, which was also not achieved. After that, it has been downhill all the way. The summer offensive of 2023 was a disaster. Bakhmut was lost with astronomic losses. The fighting in 2024 began with the loss of Avdeyevka. The Russians advanced all the way westwards, reaching the borders of Dnipropetrovsk region and putting them in a position to threaten Pokrovsk and Gulyapolye. And now we've now reached this point this year where Gulyapolye is being stormed, Pokrovsk has been lost, the Ukrainian army in Mirnograd is surrounded, and Bildzeitung has confirmed this. Kupiansk has been lost, and the Russians are fighting inside Konstantinivka, and the last major defence line in Donbass is crumbling. So Ukraine has been losing, and it is continuing to lose, and it is not losing because just because there's been a decline of Western aid or because Donald Trump was elected president in November of last year and was inaugurated president in January of this year and has tried to reach out to the Russians. Ukraine began losing after the defeat of its summer offensive of 2023 when Joe Biden was president and the support of the United States and of the European states appeared to be unwavering. And that is the reality, and that is the reality of the war, and one which we should not miss. Now, what has happened over the last 24 hours on the battlefields? Well, I will say quickly that over the last 24 hours, two Ukrainian envoys, Rustem Umerov and General Gnatov, the chief of the Ukrainian General Staff, are off to Florida to meet with Kushner and Witkoff. And entirely predictably, in advance of that trip to the United States, where the Ukrainians expect to be briefed by Witkoff and Kushner about the talks that took place earlier this week in Moscow. Anyway, entirely predictably, the Ukrainians have made all sorts of claims about successes on the battlefronts, and they've even produced a number of videos. So there's a village called Dobropolye, which is located to the north of Gulyapolye, and the Ukrainians have released film footage of some of their soldiers waving flags in the centre of this village. And they've also produced a very difficult to understand video, at least difficult to understand by me, of, from what I could tell, a solitary Ukrainian soldier walking through some part of Western Kupiansk. And these two videos are being circulated as further evidence that the Ukrainians are once again on the attack, that the situation on the battlefronts is not as bad as is being reported, that Kupiansk is still at least partially under Ukrainian control. The Ukrainians supposedly are making some kind of headway in Zaporozhye now. The Russians have failed to capture Gulyapolye, and the situation there is stable. All of that kind of thing. And of course, it has been seized on by some people. And I should say that on the Russian side of the internet, you will always find some people who have a deeply gloomy view of Putin and of his government and want him or hope that he will at some point take a much more aggressive stance in the war and start conducting what they would like to see as a total war against Ukraine. And of course, they're seizing on these videos, again, basically to criticize the Russian military authorities. By now, after all the stories and fantasies that have been circulated over the course of this war, the victory in Snake Island that never happened, the ghost of Kiev fighter pilot who never existed, the drone attacks on the refineries that precipitated a gasoline crisis which never happened, the recapture of the city of Toretsk earlier this year which never took place, the great victories the Ukrainians achieved in Kursk region last year and this year, where in fact they suffered what, until the fall of Pokrovsk, was their worst defeat. After all of these stories, I still find it incredible that people fall for this, because I have no doubt that these episodes are again basically stunts, men being sent at enormous risk to themselves into territory that the Russians control and dominate. It's not difficult given how large the front line is to find places where individual soldiers can insert themselves and roll out flags. Something like that, I remember, happened about 10 days ago in Pokrovsk. And none of this has any meaning or any reality. It absolutely doesn't mean that the Ukrainians are in control of Dobropetia, or that the Russians have been pushed out of Kupiansk or any part of Kupiansk or anything like this. As I said, Witkoff and Kushner in Florida are about to meet Umerov and Gnatov. And this has created a strong incentive in Ukraine to present a more favourable situation than the one which actually exists. If you put aside all of this propaganda, because that's what it is, and to repeat again, propaganda absolutely has its place in war. It is a normal part of war. I don't think one should be unduly critical of the Ukrainians for doing this. I am critical of those who repeatedly fall for it, but that is a different matter. But anyway, one should not be, as I said, fooled by the propaganda, which is what I have no doubt both of these latest incidents are. Rather, one should consider the actual picture. Pokrovsk has indeed fallen. Mirnograd, the garrison there, down to 1,000 men. One shudders to think what's happened to the others, is surrounded. The forces on the Ukrainian forces on the east bank of the Oskol River near Kupiansk, they're also surrounded. The Russians have broken into Liman. They're advancing in Konstantinovka. There are more reports over the last few hours that the Russians have gained more ground in Gulyapoli itself and that they're advancing further there. On the west bank of the Ganshur River, Stepnogorsk, the Ukrainian troops in the centre of Stepnogorsk surrounded, and it's not impossible that this particular town south of Zaporozhye city has fallen. And of course in Siversk, the situation of the garrison there is getting worse by the hour, as the vice that the Russians are now placing on Siversk is tightening. And over the last 24 hours, the Russians have conducted another big drone and missile strike on Kiev. Now, again, it's early time. I don't have the full details as to what this strike has achieved. It's said to be rather smaller, or rather to have had fewer drones and missiles than some of the other strikes that have taken place over the last couple of weeks. But it is likely that it was nonetheless pretty powerful and pretty devastating. And quite plausibly, there will be more big strikes and bigger strikes over the next couple of days. But anyway, the realities are that the situation for Ukraine along the front lines continues to deteriorate. And once the garrison in Mirnograd is finally quelled, which the Russians will do, they will have a secure base in Pokrovsk and in Mirnograd and in the villages to the north, the villages and towns to the north, Roditska, which they already control, Belitska, which they will soon control, Vladimirovka and Sharkova, which they're said to control already, Sofeyevka, which they will likely control also very soon, Grishino, where by some reports they've now taken more than half the village, all of these places, they will have a very, very strong operational base that they can use for further advances. And again, there is a common standard cycle or claim whenever a Ukrainian town is captured by the Russians. It might have been strategically important at one time. It might have been logistically important for the Ukrainians at some time. But that importance supposedly has gone. Pokrovsk in particular no longer played any role in Ukrainian logistics. The Ukrainian logistics have been rerouted and have bypassed it, which is of course true, but at the same time, actually a red herring. Because yes, the Ukrainians no longer are able to use Pokrovsk for their logistics, and they've had to send more of the supplies they sent to their troops in Donbass using other roads from the north through Izium and from the west. But of course, those roads are less good. The problems with the supplies are growing, and the loss of Izium, the loss of Pokrovsk, of course, is having an effect on Ukraine's ability to keep its men supplied. But anyway, so the supply situation, obviously, it's not yet terminal. But of course, when we talk about logistics, what people who make these points about the supposedly minimal effect that the loss of Pokrovsk has had on Ukrainian logistics is that there is another side, which is Russian logistics, which need to be taken into account as well. The Russians have now obtained control of a major railway and road junction. That means that they're able to link up the railways that lead into Pokrovsk into parts of the railway and road system that they already control. That means that they're in a position to supply their men in Pokrovsk from Donetsk and from other places across Donbass. Once the railway lines and the roads are brought back into a usable state, which will probably take some weeks, the trains loaded with the artillery and the shells and the tanks and the food and all of the other things and the drones and all of the other things will be ferried to, will trundle to Pokrovsk, bringing all the supplies with them. A military grouping can be built up there, and it can then advance north along the railway lines and the roads, outflanking the Ukrainian garrisons in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk and Ruzhivka and Konstantinovka. And it can also advance west also along the roads and the railway lines towards Pavlograd and the city of Dnipro on the river Dnieper. And because the Russians control Pokrovsk, they can continue to keep their men supplied even as they advance along those very same road and railway lines which lead into Pokrovsk. So capturing Pokrovsk not only puts the Russians in an advantageous geographic position relative to where the Ukrainian defences are, it also massively facilitates their logistics and their ability to keep their men supplied in battle. So, Pokrovsk has fallen. Mirnograd will soon fall. All of these other places that make up the Pokrovsk conurbation will fall as well. And that puts the Russians in a very strong position to conduct advances north and west, whichever it is that they decide to do, and quite probably it will be both. So that is the reality. Now, we also have realities about loss rates. Now, Mediazona has produced its latest update of Russian losses. The information it has provided, which it claims is based on open sources, is that it has established 149,000 confirmed fatalities on the part of the Russian army fighting in the area of the special military operation. And it guesstimates further total Russian fatalities at around 210,000. Now, these do not seem to me impossibly high figures. And in the past, I have generally gone with the Mediazona estimates. And for the record, mostly I will continue to do so and I take them seriously. All I will say is, a couple of weeks ago, I discovered who were the people who basically operate Mediazona. And all I will say is that they are people who are strongly opposed to President Putin's government. And, well, some of them, I'm sorry to say, I have encountered in the past saying things that fell short of true. So whilst the announced methodology that Mediazona uses seems to me sound, I'm not quite so sure or confident about the way that methodology is being applied as I once was. I've been starting to think that there is at least a possibility that Russian losses might be lower than Mediazona is saying. But all I will say is this, I'm going to run with these Mediazona losses for the moment. After 4 years of war, of this kind of war, these losses do not seem excessive for a country like Russia, at least to me. I, by contrast, also have information which I cannot share and whose sources I cannot provide about Ukrainian losses up to the 1st of August. Now, these figures, as I've discussed in the past, seem to me to be definitive. I know their provenance and I am fully confident of the reliability of the source that has provided them to me. And I am aware that this source is in contact with various Western agencies, the nature of which I do not intend to discuss. So, what I will say is about this information, I believe it is definitive. I believe it is authoritative and it gives a figure for Ukrainian fatalities as of the 1st of August, that is multiples greater than the figure for Russian fatalities provided by Mediazona. Now, this conforms, in terms of Ukrainian fatalities, with information that I have obtained from other sources. I spoke some weeks ago about three samples of Ukrainian and Russian troops, each sample in their hundreds. These were all troops who enlisted in the various armies, the two armies, back in 2022, and which have been involved in the war. And I said that out of the two Ukrainian samples, 80% of the soldiers in those two samples, the Ukrainian samples, were either dead or severely wounded and unable to participate in the war anymore. Whilst as to the Russian sample, which was admittedly smaller, but not significantly smaller, 80% of Russian troops in that sample, who, to repeat again, joined up in 2022, were alive and well enough to be with their regiments and to be participating in the special military operation still. Now, I've always said this was a very unscientific survey. The samples are not big enough, but they do give a sense. And for what it's worth, it is consistent with the information from Mediazona and from the source about Ukrainian losses that I have obtained. And if we go further now, there's been a really harrowing report in Reuters, which I don't want to talk about. I'm not going to read from, which talks about Ukraine now in a massive demographic crisis as a result of the war. I don't think it is an exaggeration to talk about a demographic collapse. I think the authors of the Reuters article would probably not push back too strongly against that characterization. And that came after another article in Reuters published just a few days ago about a much smaller sample of just 11 Ukrainian soldiers. From what I could tell, these were all men who had enlisted at some point over the course of this year. Several of them are dead, others are wounded, some have deserted, none of them are with the Ukrainian army or fighting in the battle anymore. So this is the actual crisis that Ukraine is facing. It's up against a military, the Russian military, that is growing in strength and power all the time, that has more men, more machines, that is now producing so many weapons that Putin recently offered to export weapons, to supply weapons, to completely re-equip the Central Asian armies that are participating in the Russian-led alliance, the Collective Security Treaty Organization, and enough weapons also to supply military material to India, S-400 missile systems, for example, alongside, of course, the production facilities to build the Sukhoi 57s, which are also, by the way, being used in the special military operation. And the Indians are apparently going to be leasing another Russian nuclear submarine. They've done this before, but it looks like they're about to do it again. So the Russians maintaining very high levels of production of weapons, enough to equip their own forces and also to equip those of their allies and to export weapons to their friends. This, even as their economy remains stable. Inflation in Russia has fallen to an annualized rate of 6%. Now, if we remember that inflation at the start of this year, annualized inflation at the start of the year was, well, it reached double digits in March. 6% inflation in Russia by year's end points to inflation below 4%, significantly below the 4% target on a day-to-day basis. The inflation crisis in Russia has ended, and that article in the Moscow Times that I was talking about now admits that over the last 3 weeks, gasoline prices in Russia have been falling. And well, growth has been less because of the high interest rates that were used to slow down the economy in order to bring the inflation down. But it does seem that there is at least growth in the economy this year, around just under 1% by some accounts. And the harvest this year, the Russian harvest food production, has been good. The harvest has been relatively big. And services PMI is now well over 50, which suggests expansion, and there's apparently been a recovery in corporate lending, all of which point to faster growth next year. So, a stable economy, able to export oil, able to cover the budget, as I've discussed, in many places, and an army that is now extremely strong, extremely well led and experienced, up against a Ukrainian army that is in a deep crisis with a country suffering a demographic crisis on top of the corruption and financial crises that also beset it. Now, as to that issue, it is today, I believe, that Ursula and Merz propose to meet in Brussels with the Belgian Prime Minister, Mr. De Vever, and they're going to lean on him very heavily to agree to Ursula's plan to provide a loan, a 140 billion euro loan to Ukraine, secured against the frozen Russian assets in Euroclear. De Vever has spoken strongly against this idea. He's also, by the way, committed the heresy of telling the truth, which is that Ukraine is indeed losing the war and that nobody really imagines any longer that Ukraine can win it. As I said, that is absolute heresy still in Europe. But anyway, they're going to pile on the pressure to do that too. And of course, Ukraine needs that money because its budget deficit is exploding in size as the domestic economy collapses and as output falls and as tax revenue falls and as demands on the budget grow. And military spending in Ukraine is growing at an exponential rate with every year that the war continues. Anyway, Ukraine desperately needs that money if it is going to cover its costs and bills over the next few months. But the Europeans are proposing to send this money to a government which, it is now universally acknowledged, is beset by corruption issues. A government where the second most powerful man, Andrei Yermak, the chief of staff, has resigned because he is implicated in the corruption scandal, and where Ukraine's chief negotiator, Rustem Umerov, on the plane off to Florida to meet with Witkoff and Kushner, is under investigation as well. It does seem rather illogical to give money to a country that is both bankrupt and massively over-debted and which is corrupt on this scale as well. By the way, my good friend Ian Proud has written about this in his invaluable Substack page, Substack site, The Peacemonger. Anyway, the Russians are now starting to make connections between the corruption in Kiev and certain investigations that are taking place in Brussels concerning corruption within the European Commission. The former EU High Representative on Foreign Policy, the predecessor of Josep Borrell and Kaya Kallas, Federica Mogherini, has been arrested and has been questioned about her role in financial corruption. And there are reports that her department, her former department, which is of course now Kaya Kallas' department, is under investigation as well. And there are rumours and stories, which I cannot obviously confirm in any way, of significant corruption within the Commission at this time. Now, I would say that I'd be careful making too many linkages between the corruption in Ukraine and in Kiev and this particular investigation. Mogherini was the EU's High Representative for Foreign Policy before the special military operation began. She was, in fact, as I remember, quite well regarded. And she seemed to me, if I have to be honest, an altogether better High Representative, in fact, a much better High Representative and representative of the EU in foreign policy matters than either Borrell or Kallas. That's not to say, of course, that the allegations against Mogherini are not true. And for all I know, she might indeed be corrupt. But I don't know that she is or the extent to which she is. And the fact that Mogherini is involved seems to mean that this scandal predates the enormous explosion of corruption in Ukraine that we have seen since the start of the special military operation, which must be the most pressing issue today. But, you know, one can get perhaps overabsorbed by the details of this and about the question of who is guilty and who is innocent in any corruption, in any particular scandal of this kind. To repeat what Alex and I have been saying, both on the Duran and on this channel, Ukraine is massively corrupt, but it is impossible that Ukraine can absorb all of these enormous flows of money that have been pouring into Ukraine over the last 4 years. I've actually had a very interesting email from someone asking specific questions about this. How is the money that is sent by Europe transferred to Ukraine? Into which accounts does it go? What is used, what is done with this money when it arrives? How is it accounted for? All of those things which we don't really get very cogent answers to. The Ukrainian economy, in my opinion, the Ukrainian military, for what it's worth, are simply not big enough, or in the case of the military, well-run and competent enough to absorb all of these vast flows of money effectively. So that must mean that much of it, perhaps an awful lot of it is leaching out. And where is it going? Well, some of it could very well be going back to the European Union. Some of it could be going to the United States. My guess is that most of it is going in all of these very interesting places, banks, in the banks that exist in all of these very interesting places in the Caribbean, in offshore islands located around the coast of Britain, in various other places in the Mediterranean and in the Far East, places where banks accept money and ask few questions and give no answers to inquisitive outsiders who want to know things. So that, I think, is what has been going on. And who, of course, is in charge of these accounts? Well, that's a completely different question again. And I'm sure a lot of them are Ukrainians. But if there are people in Europe and people in the United States, and I'm not pointing fingers at any specific person because I don't have the knowledge to do it, but if things like that have been happening, to say that I would not be surprised would be, well, a massive understatement. Anyway, so the Russians are drawing these connections. And of course, for the moment at least, Deveva is holding his ground. He is not refusing. He is refusing for the moment to countenance Ursula's loan plan. And it's starting, but he's starting to get a sense that it is not just a case of the walls closing in for the Ukrainians, for the regime in Kiev, but the walls beginning to close in for Ursula's regime in Brussels as well. And probably this is where we now get to this very strange leak by Der Spiegel of the telephone call that took place between the various European leaders. Starmer, of course, was in on the call. So was Macron. So was Merz. All good friends. They're all there. They're all talking to each other. And, well, it's an interesting call. One wonders who has leaked it. I have little doubt that in its substance we are getting a real conversation here. We see the Europeans talking with each other about how they need to protect Zelensky from the Americans, in other words, obviously from Kushner and Witkoff. We see the immense hostility to Kushner and Witkoff. And we see also the talk and the language about the Trump administration, and coming from Macron, it looks as if there was talk of betrayal and of the United States betraying Ukraine and their dear friend Zelensky in all sorts of ways. Now, there's much speculation about this leak, so I'm going to give mine, and I want to make it clear it is speculation. I think the Trump administration was very angry about the leaks of the conversations between Witkoff and Ushakov and Dmitriev, conversations which, as I've said previously, I regard as completely innocuous, but which should never have been leaked at all, because to my mind, the conversations were obviously classified. For the record, I don't think these conversations, the ones that have just been leaked now between the European leaders, are classified in the same way. In fact, I'm going to go further. I'm going to say that I don't think they're classified at all. I have said in the past that I believe that there is at least a possibility that it was a European intelligence agency that planted these leaks about the Witkoff, Ushakov, Dmitriev calls with Bloomberg. I think that someone in the Trump administration is now retaliating by demonstrating to the Europeans that the Americans know exactly what they're saying in private to each other, and basically has gone out of, has sought to embarrass them by revealing that the Americans know exactly the sort of horrible things they're saying behind his back about Donald Trump and his team. That's my guess about this leak, and I want to stress it is only a guess. But then again, I ask the question, what is the point of all of this plotting? I appreciate that some people don't like calling it plotting, what the European leaders were up to, but that's what it looks like to me. What is all this plotting for? Why are they plotting to keep Zelensky in his job and the war in Ukraine ongoing? Ukraine is losing. Its economy is collapsing. It is corrupt. Hundreds of thousands of people are dying. Hundreds of thousands, millions have fled. The Russians are taking more territory every day. Europe cannot compete with Russia in terms of arms production. The economies of Europe are in a very, very bad way. And we see, as I discussed at the start of the programme, that the campaigns to choke off the Russian economy, the restrictions on Russian oil exports, the attacks on the refineries, in which I have no doubt that Western intelligence agencies had a hand, have achieved nothing. Do these people want Ukraine to lose? I said earlier in the programme that there was no Russian plan at the start of the war to conquer and absorb the whole of Ukraine. In the spring of 2022, that danger did not exist. In my opinion, it probably does now. The appetite, as they say, grows with the eating. And I would not be at all surprised if there are more and more people in Moscow saying, well, we're winning the war. The Europeans remain impossible. The Trump people can't get their act together. Let's seek a total military victory. And let's achieve that by absorbing the whole of Ukraine. Is that what these people in Europe want to achieve? Well, it is starting to look a bit like that. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on Locals and X and our Substack site and other places. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.